I'm Jan Suk Fong Lee.
And I'm Dina Del Bucchia.
And this is Can't Lit.
Can't Lit. Talk about books and stuff.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Did you remember us from the last episode? It wasn't that long ago, so if you forgot, I hope you're okay and that you don't have any brain injuries.
Yeah, we don't want that.
But also, pay more attention. God.
Everyone must know what Tina and I are doing at all times. Everybody must know.
I feel like if you follow us on Twitter, you do know, and it's a lot.
It's exciting. We live it. We lead exciting lives.
Yeah, super exciting. Mm. Oh my God, I almost just said something embarrassing, but I'm not going to do it.
Okay. Are you sure?
So everyone, I have an embarrassing ailment, but I'm not going to tell you about it. So just the people in the room know, but not you. So just deal with it. Yeah, I can keep some secrets. Del Bucchia can keep a secret. And that is that.
Didn't you text me today or was it yesterday? Guys, friends of the podcast, that's Rosie barking at Lola the cat who's out on our deck.
Because she wants Lola the cat to come inside because they are BFFs and she wants to hang out with Lola. And it's upsetting her that Jen closed the window so that Lola can't come inside. Oh, wow. This is getting really intense.
It's like a wild kingdom. Okay, Rosie.
So anyway, the point is, I can keep secrets. It's very cool of me. The end.
I think you texted me today that now you were sharing your secret with me and now I know. So I
did say that exact thing. I told Laura last night at an event. Speaking of, our guest, very special guest as always. All our guests are very special.
They're all special.
This one's really special. Rosie agrees. Rosie really agrees. Laura Matwichuk. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Laura. Hi. It's so nice to be here.
Thank you for coming.
I'm thrilled and honored. This is just fantastic.
It's very exciting. What an exciting time. You got to watch interspecies love happening.
Yes.
Like right up close to your face.
Right up in everyone's faces. I feel good about it.
Right up in our business.
It's a heartwarming spring evening.
It really is. It's extremely heartwarming and sweet, and I love it. It is spring.
It is.
All of a sudden.
It's summertime weather, actually. It's very warm here in Vancouver right now. It's 25 degrees.
Yep. We're really experiencing climate change right now in a way that is both decadent and upsetting.
Yeah.
Enjoyable yet terrible.
As I said to someone the other day, we care about stuff, but also we're going to die. Which is interesting because we're going to talk about Laura's book, Near Miss, which I think also really handles these topics adeptly.
I think so too.
Yeah, so that's it's gonna be a real good combo.
Yeah.
That we're gonna have.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
I'm excited too. I forgot where I put my notes, but they were just in this book the whole time. Just hanging out. So, Jen, do you wanna tell us what's happening?
You know what's happening? A very long interview with me came out on CBC Arts the other day. And I had actually forgotten about the interview completely. Like I had done it on the phone and totally forgotten about it. And then it came out and she had actually told me it was a part of a series called I Fell Out of Love, where she was interviewing artists about how they keep their interest in their creative endeavors alive over the course of many years. And if you read that interview, which is really long, it just reads like the transcript of a therapy session. I realized there's like so much of like me. She's like, you know, me complaining about my career and how, oh my God, Lola is almost in my house right now. She's coming through the window.
She can't open the window. She can't do it.
Yeah. Just about how like I had a identity crisis as a writer after The Bitter Mother came out and, you know, almost quit writing and blah, 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 blah. But it was a lot. It was actually, it was good that I'd forgotten I'd done it. Cause when it came out, I'm like, oh, I did say that, didn't I? It sounds like something I would say.
I thought it was such a good interview because you talked about so many things that I think people are scared to talk about or want to keep secret like me, want to be real secretive, like this really closed off individual that you're looking at right now.
So anyway, I did fall out of love with my craft at some point. So it was a good interview.
It was good. I think it was really great. And I'm glad that lots of people got to read that whole thing. Also, I saw former guest, friend of the podcast, Vivek Shreya, also, she was tweeting, can you fall back in love with something? Did you see that?
I saw that. Yes, you can.
But
I think
the question, but she was asking people to give more information, like, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. So like wanting more than just, you know, you need space, you need time, you need this, you need that. And I found that very interesting.
I think you need space, you need time, but I also think you need like one really good reason to fall back in love with something, whatever it is, right. Whether it's because you have a really great idea, whether someone is pushing you to do something. You need like almost one really, really good reason to do it.
Also, I kept wanting to make a lot of bad jokes, but I really restrained myself. Like, like, I mean, not if you used to love ska. I don't know. All my jokes were bad.
You could still fall back in love with ska.
I mean, maybe. But anyway, I mean, obviously I was tending towards a much more ridiculous line of inquiry.
Why you gotta hate on the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones like that, Dina?
I saw them twice in concert. Don't even.
You didn't.
One time was at Lollapalooza.
Of which I am very jealous.
Yeah.
We talked about this in
here
the car.
Laura and I drove here together and we talked about concerts that we had seen because we were lamenting all of the closed venues in the city.
Yes.
I guess also a former guest friend of the podcast, Aaron Chapman, is working on a new book that is about former venues in the city in a lot of different ways. So
that's right. He is working on that.
Yeah. So that book, I think, yeah, I can't remember what it's called. Sorry, Chappie.
It has like a real catchy title.
It does. Too. It has a very catchy title. It's called Shut It Down, Vancouver.
In Aaron Chapman's voice.
Shut it down, Vancouver. Oh my God. I'm going to make a loop of you doing an Aaron Chapman impression and I'm going to play it all the time.
Hi, it's me, Aaron Chapman.
Oh my God.
Hey, it's me, Aaron.
I like that this is the direction we've gone in. Frankly, no complaints.
Wait, what's happening with you, Dina?
What's happening with me? So it's springtime.
Mm-hmm.
Classes are over for me. So technically, I'm supposed to be doing fewer things. But I just looked at my calendar and I have 7 events over the next few months.
What?
I know.
Where?
There's a whole bunch.
I'm so afraid. Yeah.
I know. But the thing is, as I was going through my calendar, I realized that only 2 of them are just readings. And if they were just readings, it would be fine. But all of the things I'm doing require like preparation and me to do completely new things. And I was like, why did I do this to myself? So it's not that I dislike events. I love events and I feel very grateful. And I know I'm really privileged because I'm in people's faces and they know that I like being on stage and that I think I do a good job.
You are so good at it.
And so I get asked to do things, but I've just realized that the amount of prep that I need to do for all this stuff is a lot. So.
And summer feels like a time to slow down, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Are these summertime events?
There's actually 2 in July.
Oh.
But most of them are this month and in May and June. Hmm. So, I mean, I'm really happy about them all. And a lot of them are different from things that I've done, but it's one of those things where I was like, you are supposed to be sitting on patios and going to the beach and reading and like eating a lot of frozen treats and making your patio spreadsheet.
I saw that
my
your favorite
project.
Patio
yeah.
is no more.
You love that patio too.
Love that patio. Is it gone forever? I'm really concerned about this.
I don't know if it's gone forever, but it won't be open this summer, as far as I know. Yeah, the Vancouver Art Gallery Cafe, or Gallery Cafe and Catering, as it is called, closed. You probably heard us talk about it on the podcast before, if you are not from Vancouver. It's been the site of many group hangouts, afternoon, sunny
memories.
Sunny memories. Yeah, just a really beautiful place. Sean and I hosted a chapbook launch there once. Like, it's just it was an amazing space. And I don't know, I think.
Say something about that patio though, particularly, which makes me really sad. It was one of the few places that I could go for a drink by myself as a woman and feel perfectly safe. Cause there aren't that many where you can go for a drink by yourself and feel comfortable and safe with a book.
Mm-hmm. And it also was a place where
a lot of people could gather. You could be with your family, mm-hmm. like people of any age could go.
My mom, sure.
Yeah, like it was just such a great space, and it's so large. Like there are so few places, especially in this city, where everything's shrinking so often, and the amount of space that people are allowed to take up is always less and less and less. And yeah, that was just a really robust space, and it was full of plant life. I saw so many rats there that I was like, yeah, you're the best. You're hanging out, eating everyone's garbage.
We took Rosie there.
Yeah, we took Rosie.
We took Rosie there. She was great.
She was great. She was so sweet.
Yeah.
And all those birds, they're going to be devastated that they don't have sandwich crumbs to eat now.
Oh, all the birds, all the different birds, There's so many species of birds.
Beautiful birds that are going to mourn and weep. But yeah, I did have one last drink there with former guest, friend of the podcast, Chelsea Rooney.
Hi, Chelsea.
Hi, Chelsea. Yeah, was a total delight. Before we went to Rhea Trankbaum's book launch, she has a new novel.
Also friend of the podcast, I feel.
Total friend of the podcast, 100%. So anyway, I have a lot of events. I'm just processing everything now. I'm sure I'll be texting both Jen and Laura for emotional support during this extremely exciting, yet poorly planned time.
Yeah. Well, I'll see. We're going to the BC Book Prize Gala tomorrow.
We are.
Dana and I with Oscar.
Yep. Rosie has to stay home. Sorry, Rosie. Yeah. Even though Rosie would look amazing in a gown, in a tux, in a formal onesie.
How about like a top hat at a rakish angle?
Yeah, obviously.
I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Rosie in a bow tie? Get out.
Rosie seems ready.
She's done. That like Lola situation has exhausted
It was her. Really stressful.
It was really stressful.
The emotional exhaustion.
It was.
There was a lot of yearning.
There was.
Laura.
What's happening?
A lot is happening, actually, because I have just launched my debut collection of poems, which is tremendously exciting for me. A total dream come true. I still almost can't believe it when the box of books arrived and I touched the actual book for the first time. Like, that's a magic that...
Did you smell it?
I did.
Yeah.
I smelled
Opened
the pages.
Opened it up. And, yeah.
Yes. Got my face right in there. Yeah. So it's just been this very surreal time of reading from the book and touring with the book with my fellow Knightwood Editions poets. I just returned from a little island tour with Cassandra Blanchard and Sarah DeLeu and Victoria Hetherington and Ali Blythe. And we were in Victoria and Courtney and Nanaimo and also launched here in Vancouver at Massey Books. So it's just been a whirlwind of warm feelings and it's been truly amazing. And I feel like I'm gaining a little bit of confidence every time I read. I was actually reading last night with Kayla Zaga and Ali Blythe and Sherita Warner. And
what a bunch of dreamboats.
I know. Hosted by Raul Fernandez.
Yes. The dreamiest of the dreamboats.
It's just like, it was a pure dream. Oh, and Molly Cross Blanchard.
Yes.
It was amazing.
Yeah. A packed house in Vancouver, which just warms my heart so much. It was really, truly fantastic. And my nerves have not dissipated through all of these readings, but it's just been an absolute joy and a privilege. And I feel very lucky right now.
That's great. I want to know a little bit more about your tour experiences. Because like your first tour, although not every author gets to tour.
No.
And so it's really awesome that you do have this opportunity and that Knightwood is supporting that and they're organizing things for you. So what has your tour experience been like?
It's been fantastic. First of all, I love going over to the island. I love BC ferries. I have a very like soft spot in my heart for the like...
Do you eat on the ferry?
Of course I do.
Tell me what I park my car.
I'm one of those people who like races to the lineup.
Yeah, you do.
I am, you know, the older I get, the faster my feet move to get my white spot specials. I usually have a salmon burger and then I stare out at the ocean. It's just, I love the whole process. It brings back a lot of warm memories for me. And I hadn't been over to Victoria in a long time, but my best friend went to UVic and at the same time that I was at UBC. So I used to go over to Victoria all the time. And so that brought back a lot of nostalgia for me too. And
basically we just, we went over and driving up and down the island was just really lovely and amazing. It's a beautiful drive. I made some playlists and I was in my car by day and then reading by night to various audiences across the island. Just lovely.
Did you have small crowds and big crowds? You had the, we ran had the
both.
Gamut.
Yeah. We had both. We had small crowds and big crowds. We kind of started small. And then by the time we were in Nanaimo at Well Read Books on the last night, there was a really warm, welcoming, larger size crowd there. It was lovely.
That's great. Totally. And have you lovely. Had any author responses to your work so far?
What do you mean author responses?
Or, not author, reader, sorry, reader responses.
Reader responses. I'm kind of awaiting reader responses. Okay. I've had a lot of people tell me that they're very excited to read the book. And then I'm hoping some of those people might follow up and share with me their honest feelings about right. what they've read. I've kind of taken every opportunity that I've, every request over the past few weeks, and everything has turned out to just be fantastic. Yeah.
Great.
That must feel really special though, because I do know like sometimes, yeah, like having be able to tour is a real privilege. It can be. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Nathaniel Moore organized the tour for the Nightwood Poets, and I don't know what we would have done without him. He was absolutely fantastic.
Friend of the podcast.
Yes.
Wrote me a nice note about Gentlemen of the Shade, Nathaniel Moore.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. He really likes my book.
Also, yeah. Lives with... Partners with friend of the podcast, Amber McMillan. Mm-hmm. It's like I don't know how to talk today.
I think
was the editor of my book.
Oh, yeah. And Amber edited your book. How was your editing relationship?
It was wonderful. We met over the phone and she was just so fantastic and full of great ideas. And so many things that she recommended really made me think about the poems in a new way. It's interesting because there's this time period that passes between... when you sign the contract and you know that the book will be forthcoming. And then there's kind of this waiting period until you actually begin the edit. So I was already feeling kind of in an unsentimental place about the work because enough time had passed that I was able to detach myself from it. And then working with Amber, I just felt really open to all of her ideas and suggestions, which were tremendous. And we had a really great conversation about the book and her recommendations were just so thoughtful and she really got where I was coming from. It was lovely.
That's great.
I'm interested, like when I was reading this book, which it occurred to me it was kind of like the poetry equivalent of watching Stranger Things in a sense. Like there's,
ooh.
Yeah, because for me,
I take that as the highest compliment.
It's yeah, I like that. I thought,
I feel like you could not have paid Laura a higher compliment. Laura loves
Winona Ryder.
Yeah, Winona Ryder, 80s horror-ish content. Like, these are all things that are totally your
wheelhouse. But it's in the book, though. Like, I feel like those things are in the book. There's that sense of, like, 80s near disaster, mm-hmm. things like volcanic eruptions, you know, like mm-hmm. the things that I always think about when I think of the 80s, how odd time it was. Mm-hmm. And disaster always seemed to be looming on the horizon. So was it stuff that you were bringing up from, like, say, your childhood, things that these sort of ingrained kind of, what are those fears, these sort of disastrous fears?
I think it started there, but it became more expansive over time, if that makes sense. Like, I think I started thinking about, like, you know, block parent signs in people's windows,
right.
and
yes.
like neighbors you don't know and that kind of suburban unease. So the poems at the beginning of the book, I feel like take place in more of that environment, which is, you know, legitimately sinister and creepy and a good place to start. And then I feel like as I expanded from there, it became more perhaps global or thinking about natural disasters and climate change and things of kind of more epic proportions. And in the midst of writing the book, I also became a mother. So then I feel like some of my greatest anxieties were transferred onto my child and being this like very vulnerable caregiver, you know, nursing a baby in the middle of the night when there's a poem about that where I felt a tremor when my child was like 6 weeks old and it was 3 a.m. and I was suddenly faced with this reality of like, oh my God, I'm responsible for this little human being, even if the building around us comes crumbling down. So you know, having written the book over a period of 5 years, I feel like all of those different permutations are in there.
Oh, I love hearing about this because I very luckily got to read an earlier draft of this book, and it's changed so much since that time.
Yeah.
And it already was great, just so everyone knows. also, just in general, like, I think we really are dismissive sometimes of our early drafts, but that's where all the sparks are. You just haven't, like, you know, you haven't pulled them into their flamey glory yet. But I think in so many ways it's more pointed, but it's also darker. And at the same time, more hopeful and kind of willing to give us as human beings and as readers this breathing space to understand that there are things to love and to appreciate. So kind of how did you arrive at maybe that sort of transitional? Because I think early on it was very, I felt like it was super fact-based initially. And then you inserted sort of this emotionality around it.
Yeah, facts, and so, statistics.
Yeah, which I think then they're 100% still in there. So how did you kind of make those choices in your revision? And did it arrive to where it is now?
I think I was maybe maturing over the process of writing the book and thinking more emotionally as the writing of the book progressed. I was in a perhaps more fragile emotional state, and I feel like some of that came out on the page, but really just like addressing the need that we all have now for coping strategies in the midst of our dire feeling circumstances. When I think about the future of the world and my in my child's lifetime and what he might be facing, like, I think we really need to consider solutions big and small for how we will cope going forward. And having a hopeful attitude, I feel like, is fundamental. We have to be in the mental space to prepare for what lies ahead. So I felt like it was important to kind of get there in the poems too, from a position maybe of bleakness about the things that we can't control to taking some comfort in the things that we perhaps do have control over, however small they might be.
Yeah, because you're not letting anything off the hook. You're not letting anyone off the hook. You're not like smoothing anything over. It's exactly what you just said, like this way of sort of seeing the ways that we can move forward and cope.
Yeah, because we must, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like this whole, when motherhood cropped up in here and I saw it, I'm like, yeah, that's what I wanted to see. but one of the things that it reminded me of is when I used to be in this like postpartum baby group after Oscar was born. And I remember us talking about the different forms that depression after you have a baby can take. And I remember one of the women in the group saying, I keep seeing visions in my head of disaster, things, terrible things happening to the world, to my baby, to our family.
Yes.
And as I was reading this, I'm like, I felt not that you were writing about that specifically, but it felt like there was a almost kind of circling around this kind of imagining of disaster because of parenthood. Does that make any sense at all?
Totally. Yeah. And I've heard other mothers speak about that, and I felt that myself, just like ridiculous things. You imagine pianos dropping from windows and you're pushing your stroller down the sidewalk and you're thinking, okay, if that happens, what's my strategy? Like, cause you're just, your mind is just on another planet sometimes. And I think you have a very, you're in a very intimate relationship with a very helpless person, and you just feel like you need to be equipped for all the unpredictability of life. And so that maybe helped me to like think about disasters in more expansive terms. Like, what about this situation? What about this like highly improbable situation? Like, I can't deny the fact that we, you know, we live on a shifting tectonic plate here in Vancouver, and that has always been a concern for me, but it became a heightened concern. And then I thought about people living on volcanic islands and just the kind of the day-to-day of that, the epigraph at the beginning of the book, I feel like has always been my touchstone for all of these themes. And we would go on as if nothing was wrong, that absolutely necessary mental state, physical state. You must go on wherever we're living in the world, whatever the circumstances, as parents, as children.
So like what is normal is what we're constantly looking for. And I think you're sort of parsing that consistently throughout the poems. Like what is normal both externally in the world and then internally in ourselves and our psychological state.
And in our culture too. Like I feel like I see it reflected there. Like I love a good disaster movie. I always have. Like I could watch the movie 2012 starring John Cusack.
I've never seen this. Over again.
I've never seen it either.
He plays kind of like a down on his luck writer who works as a limo driver, and he's married to Amanda Peet and they have a couple of kids. And then these climate disasters start happening in rapid succession over what feels like a period of like 5 hours. The whole world is just going up in flames. And I think like it's not Randy Quaid. It's,
is it Dennis Quaid?
No, it's not Dennis Quaid. It is.
No Quaids are involved. No Quaids are in this
movie. If there's no Quaids, I always go immediately.
It's
the Baldwin.
From Cheers.
Oh, Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson.
Oh.
Woody Harrelson is camped out in his van in Yellowstone National
Park. I somehow
National
was really
Park.
Hopeful it was going to be George Wendt because I just love George Wendt.
Maybe that would have been a better choice.
I mean, I also love Woody Harrelson. Everyone from Cheers, thumbs up. That's all I
know.
I have to say.
Shelley.
Shelley Long forever. Shelley. We could talk about Shelley Long for 2 to 3 hours. Anyway.
So anyways, I think I was making a point about...
You were like, talking about the John Cusack film.
Yeah. So they're just kind of these like movies that I love that also tread in that subject matter, that like end of the world, that like, you know, Golden Gate Bridge collapsing.
Oh, I was going to ask about this. Do you like the 70s? Like, do you like the Poseidon Adventure?
Yes, Poseidon Adventure.
Okay, Shelley Winters.
Very special.
Huge hero.
Yeah. Also Shelley Winters.
Shelley Winters is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible.
And she swims. She does that like in the, her beautiful gown. Anyway, yes, she's amazing. I love her. I love it. It's one of my favorite things. Boat. I love it so much.
Yeah.
And Towering Inferno.
Towering
Earthquake.
Inferno. Earthquake.
Yeah.
I don't know that I prefer those movies, but I just... It's the type of thing that I will watch over and over again.
But it doesn't matter. The delivery system is what you're saying.
Yeah. Just the collapsing of these monuments and structures, even like Independence Day. I remember, you know, lining up outside the theater. When was that? Like 1996, 97,
98.
Yeah. Around
that.
Like,
yeah. I was in university, I think.
Yeah. Just all of that kind of material somehow feels connected to my childhood, renting movies with my dad when I was young, and just kind of being exposed to this, like, this is a thing we like to think about. We like to think about the end of the world and we like to visualize what that might look like. And something about it feels kind of perversely good to see monuments go up in flames or
would
down.
Say that you don't want to close your eyes. You don't want to fall asleep because I'll miss you, babe. And I don't want to miss a thing. Etc. Would you say that?
I would say that.
Okay, great.
And I don't, maybe don't even want to talk about how many times I've seen Armageddon. Like drilling in space.
Did you watch Deep Impact also?
I feel like Deep Impact doesn't hold a candle to Armageddon. There is something very, very special about Armageddon.
I just
Armageddon.
Remember the competition between the two of them.
Which
was a
one?
Big deal.
I've never seen either of these
movies. Were like the two disaster movies at this kind of, I don't
they
even know.
They came out
I
the
was gonna
same
say,
summer.
I was going to say third wave, but it might even be like a sixth wave.
Wait, which one
of
is Armageddon?
Movies?
Is that the one with Ben
Bruce,
Affleck?
Ben Affleck. Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis.
Ben Affleck.
Liv Tyler.
Liv Tyler.
Oh.
Aerosmith.
Oh, she was Bruce Willis's daughter.
Yes.
Oh.
And she grew up on an oil rig. And she calls him by his first name. And then he has this like ragtag team of...
Oh, yeah. Wait, who else is in it?
Of oil
Steve Buscemi in it?
Steve Buscemi.
I'm remembering things.
Steve Buscemi.
This is sounding more and more like Roadhouse.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about Roadhouse?
Well, it also overlaps with Con Air a little bit with the like gang of like...
Ragtag.
Mentally unstable weirdos. And then somebody's the voice of reason. Maybe it's Ed Harris and it's like, can we send these guys into space? Are they mentally fit to like...
Ed Harris
go
is
on a rocket.
Reason.
Is it Ed Harris?
I think it's Ed
Who's
Harris.
Who's like in the command center.
I think you're
like,
right.
Loosening his
He's
top
always
button.
in a command center in Paris.
Isn't he also in the command center in Apollo 13?
He's Apollo 13.
Well, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe it's not Ed Harris.
Listen, let's just pretend it's Ed Harris. He's getting full credit for this.
He's either in a command center loosening his tie, or he's marrying Julia Roberts and Susan Sarandon is dying. This is the only association I have with
Ed
Harris.
These are all really fair.
This is all speaking to the fact that the details are a little fuzzy and it's time to watch Armageddon again.
The poems in here are so linked and so cohesive, and they so all go together. So my question is, during all this time that you're writing it, were you writing other poems too that didn't fit this theme?
Yeah, I think there were poems that definitely didn't make it into the book. And the structure of the book was kind of like a puzzle for me for a long time. And it took several different forms before I kind of knew what it should look like. And then when that became clear to me, the poems that remained, that I needed to write to complete it, that became very easy. Like, I knew what was missing all of a sudden when I knew what the structure of the book should be and the things that should link it. Like, throughout the book, there are a series of dream poems, and then there are pages that have questions, and then there are these testimony poems that relate to...
I have questions about both the dream poems and the question poems.
Yeah.
So...
And then there are the testimony poems, which are sound poems about near misses involving drones.
I love that there are drones in
your
book.
So I kind of peppered those throughout the book to bring it together. But the book, the format of the book had earlier... There were earlier iterations that didn't have any of this kind of construction around them. So it was something that I played with quite a lot.
Yeah, I love it. I love that there are many different types of poems. But again, as Jen said, these different types of connective tissue, like, it's not just one thing. A lot of times a book will have sort of one thread. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as you just mentioned, there are these pages in the book that are almost blank, except for these individual italicized questions.
Yes.
So not only do they stand out because of all the white space, but also they're italicized. Like, they look different visually than the other poems. And so those really made me feel as though they were coming from a place of concern.
Yes.
But as well as, like, this really pointed questioning that served to interrogate both the reader and the speaker of the poem. And so for you, what did these questions mean for the book?
They have a very specific point of origin. I was reading about the types of questions that survivors of near misses or disastrous situations are typically asked to determine if they are okay or how they are coping in the aftermath of either a natural disaster or a kind of near-death experience. So that's what the questions speak to directly.
Can I ask, like, who is asking these questions?
I suppose it would be kind of like in a medical context, like the sorts of things that, like, a doctor would ask to kind of get a sense of your emotional and mental state following your, you know, survival of a major
environmental disaster. Right, so these are almost like a technical, clinical type of question.
Yeah, I wanted it to have that kind of remote, omniscient voice.
Yeah, I really love that. And then on the other side of it, the dream poems. Mm-hmm. Dreams are one of those things where people so often hate to hear about dreams that other people have. I'm not one of those people. I actually think people that think dreams are boring people. Is that terrible? Like,
who doesn't want to hear about dreams?
There's tons of people who are like, you'll be like, oh, I had a crazy dream last night. I had a wild dream last night.
Oh, I always want
to
know.
And they'll be like, ugh, don't tell me about that. And I'm like, go to the bathroom. I don't want to look at your face. I love it. Mm. That's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's anything boring or uninteresting about these sort of strange things that happen while we are asleep, when we're extremely vulnerable, which is similar to what we're like in any type of disaster or distress. So
totally.
I think perhaps tell us, like, about sort of the dream sections. Yeah, where these are coming from.
Yeah, I think perhaps you're at your most vulnerable in a dream when anything is possible, when anything can happen. There are no limits. That's what's so terrifying. But I think, you know, dream related poetry remains kind of a preoccupation for me, because I feel as like a mode of writing, it's also a way to access things that are maybe a little bit more strange or don't make sense. And it offers me a pathway in.
I feel like it can, if you want to let your brain take you there afterwards, like let you actually think about sort of the vulnerabilities,
yeah,
of who you are. It's like anything. Like, to me, a dream is similar to art in that it has all these images. I mean, I'm not a Freudian or anything, but it's still like a poem is up for this type of interpretation where,
yes,
you can take the leading clues or not.
And yeah, it feels like maybe a creative way to think about solutions to the thoughts you have while you dream may, I find, be strangely applicable or comforting, because they present you with scenarios so wild and improbable and surreal that you wake up feeling, or at least I do sometimes, like, well, I can cope with whatever disasters await me today, because like, look what I've just done via dreams while I'm sleeping. Like, there's just kind of a strange confidence that comes,
yeah,
from...
Yeah, like, and you have to calm yourself down. Yes. You have to like go through all these...
Sorry. Oh, Oscar's my goodness.
Oscar's
having a good time, you guys.
Yeah. Oscar is here loving life. He's having no bad dreams right now.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, only that I once had a dream that Dina and I were dating. Do you remember that?
I love that dream, and I wish it was true.
It was very sweet. It was a sweet... Like, I told someone then. They got all, like, weird and sexy about it. I'm like, no, it wasn't like that.
This is the thing, though. If you tell anyone a dream that involves, like... Even if you're holding someone's hand, they're like, oh my God, look at your boner. And you're like, okay, calm down. Like,
it was like that. I felt
literally
like,
not everything is about boners.
I feel like we went to see a movie. We might've been holding hands. We might've kissed once. Yeah. And it was like very sweet.
That's very sweet.
It is sweet.
Romantic.
Sweet. I've definitely had, sweet dreams about people that, they don't have to, not everything has to go to Bone Town.
Not everything has to go to Bone Town, but also I think dreams explore the holes in your own, whatever holes you have. I don't know if I should call them holes, but holes that you have that your dreams need to fill.
There's a crack in everything. Mm-hmm. That's how the light gets in, et cetera.
Exactly.
Love that guy.
Yeah. We know you love that guy.
I mean, that's not his best quote, but it's good.
Yeah. People love it.
People do love it.
People love it.
Dreams exist.
How many tattoos do you think exist of them?
So many.
Like 1 million?
And how many are spelled wrong though, right?
It's like, really excessive. Yeah, if I got a Leonard Cohen tattoo, it would not be that quote.
100%. No, you'd pick something funnier or raunchier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically I feel like dreams are another kind of coping mechanism, if you want to look at it that way. Like, they can be a way to, there, I think a lot of things can be resolved in sleep that can kind of make you wake up the next day feeling more hopeful.
That's a really optimistic and lovely way to think about sleep, actually.
Because you can conquer things that are much worse than perhaps what will happen next. And I think it can be a comfort.
It feels so real.
Yeah. And it feels so real. So I guess there's a kind of bizarre false confidence that comes with it, but I'll take it.
I mean, sometimes false confidence is all we have.
Yeah.
It's all I have most days, and it's fine.
Embrace it.
Yeah. Embrace it.
So I'm going deep into your past. I'm not really going deep into your past. But you studied art and art history.
I did.
And are a very smart person about very many things, including very important art, pop culture. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wonder, how does your academic background combined with your sort of cultural consumptive brand, like, all of that stuff, mm-hmm, sort of come together in this work? Like, how does it figure in?
I think it's there, perhaps quite subtly.
And again, it doesn't have to be overt, but I know I could tell from reading some of the poems, like things were kind of coming out for me.
Yeah.
But
I was thinking how people who know me well might respond to the book a little bit differently, seeing the kind of, seeing some of my preoccupations on the page would come as no surprise to people who know me well, making those connections. But yeah, it isn't lost on me that I'm a child of the 80s and 90s who grew up on a lot of movies, like renting movies with my dad was probably like the foundation of our relationship. And we would go to the video store and he introduced me to like, yeah, all of these
important
things.
Question. What was the video store that you went to called?
Oh, there were so many, but there were,
oh, right. Cause I, again, grew up in a small town. So it's hard for me not to be like, well, what was your store?
Yeah. There were probably four or five that we frequented.
What was the best name?
In Abbotsford. I think it started with Video Stop in the early 80s. And then there were some other like independent video stores along the way. There was one that I used to go to with my best friends and we would like go in our pajamas down to like the bottom of the mountain and rent videos. But going with my dad to the video store was like a big deal. And then he would get excited about showing me things, that he wanted me to see, like Star Wars or like Indiana Jones for the first time. And he would be so pumped about this, like very enthusiastic. And now I can see myself like having those same feelings about my own son. And just like, I can't wait for him to be old enough to watch, you know, E.T. or, you know, these touchstones of the 80s of, you know, John Hughes movies or whatever. So that's definitely embedded in the book, that kind of upbringing, that kind of time period, which I think is like kind of a shared experience that we might have being of a similar age. But it was just such a thing, like that. It was screen time, but in a different form. And I don't think people called it that. And I don't think people were critical of it, but yeah, from, you know, Singing in the Rain to The Goonies, I was just, yeah. I was trained on movies.
And I think too, well, like when we talk about screen time, again, I'm a child-free person. I cannot comment on parenting in the way that you can, but the concept of screen time to me is fascinating because I think a lot of time it's used in a way where sometimes parent and child aren't interacting, and that's what you're talking about. And I think like some kids do have that interaction and some don't, right? And so there's all of these different ways that we both interact with screens and we interact with art, mm-hmm. in ways that involve us experiencing it independently, mm-hmm. and also experiencing it with like some type of parental intervention or teacher intervention or whatever it is, where like we get some contextual information and sometimes we don't. Sometimes, yeah, we just get to watch a thing and we're like, this is the thing I love and I'm going to watch it a bunch of times. But when you're doing that exact thing, like your dad, like you're going to do.
Yeah. Okay. So my dad's favorite movie was Singing in the Rain. He loved his movie musicals, and it was my favorite movie because he showed it to us. He was always very excited to show it to us. And I showed it to him. He was about six. He loves this movie. And then after he saw it, he was trying to run up the wall like Donald O'Connor.
I mean, who doesn't want to do that?
Make him laugh.
Make him laugh. Make him laugh. Make him laugh.
Still to this day, it's one of his favorite movie scenes.
But coming back to what you were saying about screen time, it's like that term has become so sinister. But for me, I just have like the warmest childhood feelings of watching things, I guess, on screens with my dad and him being like excited about it. And therefore I was excited about it. And maybe it turned me into this like, movie junkie, but no, I think that's bad.
I think we're all like culture junkies though. And I remember having so much interaction with my dad watching television in a way that we almost never did in any other context. I don't think. Yeah.
It was never like a surrogate babysitter, like, no. Hey kids, sit down in front of the,
again, which is still,
although
fine.
I do make a joke about that in the book.
That, fine. Great. Yeah, you do. But I think that's also fine. Like there were definitely times where we would come home from school and my mom would still be cooking dinner and my dad wouldn't be home yet. And my brother and I mean, my choices were always, listen, I just want to watch Gilligan's Island. This is what I'm into.
I watched that so much with my grandma.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Gilligan's Island with your grandma?
That's amazing. But it's the concept of screen time to me takes on this idea that, and again, we're all writers, we're people who are creative, like that saying that the people who are creating that work aren't artists. Mm-hmm. And that's what pisses me off about it. Mm-hmm. Like this idea that the people, the artists who are animating, if it's a cartoon, all of these things are happening and people have worked to make this piece of art and it might be bad. Like I've seen Paw Patrol. It's not good.
Oh,
but people worked very hard on it.
I mean,
like it's, I'm not saying it's what I want to enjoy. But I think that's the other thing too. Like, people have put work into it, and there are, I mean, this is why we have cultural criticism overall. Like, there are things that we assign value to over others. And so,
well, and coming back to your question, I can totally see the line between my upbringing in the 80s and 90s on old movies and classic movies and all of that, and my interest in visual culture as I, you know, went to university and studied art history for many years.
And wrote a thesis.
Yeah. And all of that. Like, I think just like digesting visual information has always been, it just felt like a default mode for me.
Yeah, I'm really, I don't know, I'm really fascinated by that. I feel very protective of the idea. I've said this many, many times. I've said that I want it on a shirt and maybe on a tattoo, even though I'm the one who said it, that pop culture is my culture. And I think pop culture actually encompasses a lot more than we give it credit for. Like, this book is pop culture. Like, books of poetry are still popular culture. Like, the things that we experience, that we read, that we enjoy, it doesn't just have to be a Marvel movie that is pop culture, even though that still is. Like, it's all of these things, and we just have a lot more culture now, so parsing it is just a lot more work and energy. And but it also gives us more freedom to be like, I know that I don't want to experience this, but I do want to experience this.
I read some of your poems last night to my out loud to my partner, and he,
what did Jeff say?
He doesn't read poetry.
Tell Jeff if he doesn't read my book, I'm coming over and we're going to have a wrestling match.
Oh, he'll read it. He'll read it. He doesn't want to wrestle anybody. He's a lover, not a fighter. But like, I read it to him and he's like, he said, wow, that means a lot. But it was like, it was, it, he listened to it. He was really into it, and he was not going to make a lot of comments on it, which is fine. But he did enjoy me reading it to him.
That's cool.
That's beautiful.
I like that. So
also, your poems read beautifully out loud for other people. Like, oh, for me, because I didn't write them. So I was reading them out loud and I hadn't read them out loud before. And they read beautifully out loud.
Thank you so much. I agree. I just, yeah, I've heard Laura read a few times, and last night you read. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things, again, that's so striking about your poems is you have such a good, and again, I think this encompasses all the things we were just talking about in terms of culture and art and all of these things, but you're, eye for details in terms of the images are so specific. And I love that so much. Like, it is something that I love in poetry very, 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 very much. And so last night you read a poem where there is a kind of extended sort of like, almost like a shot on a fridge.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think your book talks a lot about natural disasters and climate change and what's outside, but there's also all of these things, because we can't escape it, that are human made, that are included. So there's this scene of like a fridge, which is probably full of things that used to be alive. Mm-hmm. And there's a parent and a child in the poem, but then there's a magnet that is holding up an image of something that is alive. And like, it's all of these sort of intersections of the natural world and the human made world kind of coming together. And I think your book does that extremely beautifully. Like, I love that about your book. And I think that's where like the imagistic stuff, the specific stuff really comes together. Like, it's not just a magnet, which is like a plastic thing with a magnet in it. It's a rose magnet. So it's, again, another transposition of a real existing in nature, living thing that is now made plastic. And you really like weave those. So those types of images are so striking to me in your work. And I think
you really get to the heart of it. Like, that's exactly what I would have hoped for.
Okay, good. Yeah. But so like, how are you sort of thinking of that connectivity when you're approaching a poem like that? And that happens in many different poems, but last night hearing you read it aloud, I kind of had a vague note before the reading last night. And then while you were reading, I went into my Google Doc and I was like typing stuff in immediately. Cause I was like, oh, this is exactly what I was trying to say when I was preparing for the podcast, but it all came together hearing you read. Mm-hmm. So
I think it comes back to something that I've often talked about with Sherita Warner. Brilliant poet.
Former guest, friend of the podcast. And
who
was really with me every step of the way in writing this book. And we had lots of conversations about it and about poetry's role in bringing the most special, most specific language to the forefront. Like, I really think that's what poetry can do. Like, to say something in the most special way you can think of. And so I often kind of would interrogate drafts of my own poems with that in mind. Like, why does this belong here? Does it? Why this thing this way? And it has to be worthy. Like, it has to meet those criteria. And I think Sherita, in reading drafts of my poems, always helped me to kind of turn up the volume on what was already there and make it that deserving, special thing. And, you know, she's a mentor to a lot of people, and I think she really helps people to dig deeper for those things.
Oh, I love that. But I totally,
I'm gonna cry.
I know. But I feel like I do the same thing, but I never would have kind of worded it that way. Like, when I think about the language in each poem, I'm like, is this too basic? Like, am I going too easy on the poem? And I think for me, it's coming, like, that's really positive. Going, but for me, easy, it's always like a negative place where I'm like, you really gotta fuck this poem up. Like, it's always more aggressive. But the intention remains the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that. No, you're right. This is very emotional.
I'm going to cry. No, because it's true though. But I think that's true for every project that you write, regardless of genre, or any project that you create, or whatever artistic, you know,
thing
you're doing. Applicable to poetry exclusively at all.
There's a point where I tell my students, and when I'm editing, I tell the authors too, that there is a point in your sort of final draft where you actually do have to interrogate every single thing that's there. Why is it here? What is it doing? How many things is it accomplishing? And if it's doing nothing, then it has to go. Or you have to make it relevant. You have to support its presence in the narrative, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing. But I mean, you put it much more beautifully, so that's all. I'm just like, what's it doing? Is it doing nothing? Get rid of it!
Yeah! Well, and I think my, whatever you want to call it, academic training always kind of pushed me to think in those terms, even when I was studying art history. It was always about, like, what is at stake? What is at stake? Like, because you can dig up any work of art and make it the subject of your thesis, but there better be something there. You can't just write about a photograph that you love for its own sake. And that was a question, that was like the primary question always, what is at stake? And I think I carried that over into poetry, and it felt just as relevant. It's the thing.
Yeah, it is the thing.
It's the thing.
Jen, you know what thing it is now?
Oh yeah.
It's time for your emotion corner.
I'm so excited.
I was already like starting to cry about this whole...
about the beauty of love language. Okay, I have the timer set.
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Okay, so we're recording this episode 2 days before Mother's Day. So everyone knows I've got emotions about Mother's Day, because these are made up holidays that make us all feel bad. Bad. So what's going to happen is on Sunday, I will wake up and see all these Instagram posts of people who have two-parent families, whose partners have made them cute pancakes that are shaped like a Mickey Mouse ears, and the kids will smile for the camera, and they'll hold out a pink rose for their mom, and it'll make me feel bad because there's no one here to do that for me on Sunday, or to help, you know, the kid choose a necklace for me, or to pick the roses or anything like that. And what pisses me off about it is that it will actually make me forget that I actually do have the family that I want, that I really love my family. I really love my kid, who only cares about comic books and paella. He really loves paella. And like, my like weird little garbage dog who like has a weird little cat friend named Lola. I love them and I love my family, and it makes me forget that I actually really love my family and have the family that I want. So whatever, no more made up holidays, no more made up pretend capitalist holidays. They can all suck it.
Suck it. I agree with that so much. I love it so much.
It just exists to make us feel bad.
Love is free. It's for everyone.
Love is for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
just February
friend of
14th.
The podcast, Ryan Fitzpatrick, has been writing about care lately on his blog, and it's been really interesting. Yeah, just like the concept of wanting care and not being able to receive it because you're not in a romantic partnership and what that looks like. And mm-hmm. yeah, I always think he's a super interesting mm-hmm. person and writer and thinker. And yeah, the idea of care extending to more than just the people in your immediate life is, I mean, it's something that I really personally try
yeah,
to.
I know. Yeah.
You know.
I know.
I'm going to cry now. But like, it's something that is very important to me. And yep. so to have people having more conversations about that, I think is also really, really important.
Different forms that care can take as families change, as our lives change, as, you know, the formations of our communities change. Those, the concept of care is ever more important mm-hmm. with all the people that we can get it from and give it to.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah. And again, we are all going to get older, hopefully. And if we don't,
we're all going to live in the same condo like the Golden Girls with a lanai.
The fact that people don't aspire to that is ridiculous.
We all aspire.
I'm aspiring to it.
It's going
to
be great.
I'm ready to provide cheesecake to all the people that want it.
We're going
to
wear robes and drink fruity drinks in the middle of the day.
Okay.
Okay, you're going to rage?
Complaining about gas prices. Get a more fucking interesting hobby, greaser. I don't care. Newspapers constantly downsizing. Mass layoffs of journalists. When people who are trying to do the difficult work to find out information that the corrupt pieces of shit running this screaming dirt basket are constantly trying to hide from us. That makes me want to blow fire from all of my orifices and torch so much shit. But we are still fighting over abortion and reproductive rights.
Why?
Fuck that shit. I will personally plant an ectopic pregnancy in the eye socket of anyone who makes it their business to take away reproductive rights. Okay. Those jeans that are cut off and slightly frayed at the ankle, I just can't. I'm sorry, and I don't like it, and I don't have to defend myself or apologize for it. I don't like the way it looks, and I don't care. Yours are cropped appropriately and look good.
I have a pair of
just
those.
So you know. I don't. It's weird. Celery juice. Celery juice.
Celery juice. Hey, I'm with you on the celery
that
juice.
That was the last thing.
Nobody likes celery juice.
I don't know what it is. Those jeans piss me off.
At the last moment, the exclamatory celery juice.
I have a pair of those cropped to the ankle free.
I don't think I've seen you wear them.
I don't wear them except to walk the dog.
They're called Levi's wedgie jeans. Is that what they're called?
And something wedgie jeans.
I think that's what they're called. And they are everywhere.
You know what? They're going to be gone in literally moments.
They're spreading like wildfire. I own them myself, I must admit.
Enjoy your time with them.
Mine are like knockoff American Eagle versions of them.
Of course they are. This is what people are supposed to have. You don't have to have the fanciest ones. There's just something about it when I see it where I'm like, this is going to be something that people are wearing for 8 to 10 months and then this is going to end and it's fine.
I don't hate them.
That's fine.
Is it because
for whatever reason they anger me? I don't hate them.
You know they're comfortable.
But do I? Like, think of another trend. I'm going to ask both of you this question now. That you wore previously that you were like, this was amazing. And now you're like, this was a bad idea.
Oh, like those low rise, really tight, yes. The butt pants that were flare at the bottom.
Yeah, that was
those were bad, 100%.
Those super low rise jeans.
Super low rise.
Ooh.
Like you couldn't wear them with proper
pants. When I worked at the Gap, that was like the hot time that. Mm-hmm. And we all got a free pair of them to wear. There's a lot of weird stuff going on.
And they were just not flattering for anyone. The only way it ever looked good is if you wore them a real high heel and a real long shirt. And like, what are these things?
I recently watched a documentary about Alexander McQueen.
Oh, me too.
And I think this trend began with him. I think it's his fault.
But it was a joke. He did it as a joke.
I know. And then all of a sudden jeans were like that, where like the zipper on the jean would be like this long.
Yeah. Well, because then he did like a lot of slim pants that were like that. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, this was like a fun thing. Did you watch the documentary?
No.
It's really enjoyable.
Really fascinating.
Yeah. It's great.
But like the bumster thing.
Isabella Blow.
Yeah. There's so much in it.
Anyway, I had a real, real olive green pair that were really low real tight.
Oh my God.
Yeah. They were great.
I mean,
No, they weren't. I had to wear terrible underwear with them. They were just terrible.
Yeah, that, I mean,
whatever. I regret that. I don't regret the big Dickies overalls I wore when I was 17.
Those are obviously great.
I don't. Yeah, but that I regret.
Seeing people now wearing overalls is so great, and I love it. And I love my overalls, and I wear them all the time, and they're the best.
Overalls are great.
I stand by them. They're a delight. They're a delight. Mm-hmm. I feel great in them.
I want a pair.
I feel cute as a button. So we're going to start to wrap up here.
Yeah.
You can find us at cantlit.ca. Cantlit on Twitter. Cantlit on Facebook. I'm at Del Botchery on Instagram. Jen.
I'm at Jen Leifer.
Like the animal fur. And we always post our selfies on Instagram as well as our other social media for every episode. Please, we would love your 5-star reviews. We would love to hear from you. So tweet at us. We respond very well to tweets.
Or not so well.
It depends on the tweet that we get. I also want to say I have 7 events coming up. So please come to some of them.
Yeah, please do.
I am doing an event called Nerd Night at the Fox Cabaret on May 22nd.
Yes, you are. Friend of the podcast, Sean Krause, is going.
Oh, he told excellent. Me. Yeah. And I can't remember the other host's name. I'm so sorry. But my friend that I've known for many years since I worked at Chapters, Michael John Unger, is one of the hosts, and it's a night where people who are really nerdy about something talk about it. And so I'm going to talk about poetry and in my presentation that is called Poetry is Fucking Fun. So again, I know poetry can be serious and groundbreaking and whatever, but I feel like if you're going to convert people, this is what you got to do. Talk about how it's fun on May 24th. Real Vancouver Writers Series.
I'll be there. You want to hang out with
Jen's going to be there. Laura will be reading.
Yeah. I'm so excited.
Yes. We have many amazing readers. It's going to be really fun.
Come see me. I'll buy you a drink.
Yep. Jen will buy you a drink. It's going to be at the Accessible Auxiliary Space next to Grunt Gallery on West 2nd Avenue in Vancouver. Awesome. Please go. Oh, I don't know what our website is. I think it's realvancouver.org. Don't at me. Sean changes it all the time.
Twitter handle is at RVWS though, isn't it?
It's at realvancouver_.
Oh no!
You're close. And so those two, I guess those are the only two. Oh, and there's a few spots left in my master class as part of the Creative Nonfiction Collective Conference. Last I checked, there were 4 spots left in a master class that I'm doing about inserting comedy into your writing. So if you think I'm funny, come. If you don't think I'm funny, definitely don't come because you're going to be really disappointed.
Everyone should go. All my students who listen to the podcast, you should all go because they ask me that question all the time. How do you write comedy?
It's a question that I get even in my own class that is about writing comedy. So I feel like I've never done so much promo, but this is what I'm about.
Well, I mean, you may as well because I have nothing on the books because all I'm doing is writing.
I'm not doing any writing, so we're split off.
Yeah, we're basically balancing. The two of us together are a balanced normal person.
Together, you're perfect.
Together, we're great. I'll have more things to tell you about next time that are taking place later on. So the masterclass is June 14th.
I'm not so...
It's fine.
Findable.
It's fine. If you don't want people, people can go to Knightwood's website. You can purchase Laura's book there.
Yes.
Yep.
Come to the Real Vancouver.
Come to Real Vancouver. There will also be books there. May 24th. It's a fun Friday. Friday night fun time. Yeah. So we only have one question left. Laura, what can't you with?
I've given this a lot of thought. As a longtime listener of this podcast, and I think I have to go back to the original one that I imagined saying long ago when I was the parent of a younger child who I would push around in a stroller. I have to say, I can't with the people who cross an intersection, step onto the curb on the other side, and then stop without looking behind them at the mothers who are often pushing strollers and would like to get out of the way of traffic as well. So if you're walking and you have crossed the street, turn behind you. There may be a stroller there and there may be a woman who is scared for her life.
There may be any number of people. Yes. There could be someone in a wheelchair. There could be just a slower person than you.
Like, I suppose I can't with a lack of spatial awareness.
Yeah. on the streets of a city. Be spatially aware, people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Laura lives near a somewhat dangerous intersection.
I do.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of perilous times in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Be spatially aware when you're walking on the sidewalks. Leave room for people to come up onto the curb
spatially,
behind you.
Spatially aware. Spatially aware.
Thank you.
Okay.
So you've got your spatially aware theme song. You're ready to move on. Laura, you are a delight. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This is a dream come true.
And please buy Laura's book, Near Miss. It is out now with Nightwood Editions. We'll tell you about more books to buy next time
on Can't Lit the Podcast, the podcast that you love to listen to. You love it.
Can you do an Aaron Chapman to send us off?
You all listen to Can't Lit's me, Aaron Chapman.